Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A recent article in the Los Angeles Times came to our attention. It's a fascinating and important story, the search for the lost Nazi diary. Henry Mayer, son of a Holocaust survivor, made it his mission to find the long-lost diary kept by Alfred Rosenberg, the Nazi Party's chief ideologue and a confidant of Adolf Hitler. The diary covers the years 1936 to 1944, and it includes Rosenberg's accounts of meetings with Hitler, describing fighting among Hitler's inner circle, and reveals the depths of Rosenberg's anti-Semitism. The story to find this takes years and years, and it involves the FBI and people who made promises and reneged on the promises and relied on, really, the story does, the determination of Henry to find this diary, which he knew existed, and lo and behold, he found it. This hour of the program, we'll talk about the search and what's in the diary. Henry Mayer is a senior advisor on archives in the Office of Collections at the United States Holocaust Museum. Henry, thank you very much for being with us.
Most welcome.
Yeah, and also joining us is Jurgen Tius. He is Director of Applied Research Scholar at the United States Holocaust Museum. Jurgen, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this story is absolutely fascinating. Let's start with the importance of the diary. Henry, when did you know about the existence of this diary and decided that it was around and you had to get it?
Well, we first knew about it. It had been long rumored that this diary existed, this portion of the diary existed, and that Dr. Kempner had it. And so the search for it began almost immediately from the beginning.
And Dr. Kempner was who?
Dr. Robert Max Vasily Kempner was the chief of research at the International Military Tribunal at Nuremberg, and he was deputy chief prosecutor at the subsequent tribunals. There had been 11 of them. At Nuremberg, he was the chief prosecutor in the so-called Ministries case, which was a major case involving members of the Foreign Service and the Foreign Office of the Nazi government.
Mm-hmm. And how did we know that there was a diary? There were portions of this diary used at the Nuremberg trials, is that right, Rosenberg's diary?
They were not used. They had been amassed in case they had been wanted to use them as evidence. So they weren't necessarily used as evidence, but they were noted and made available for evidence should the need arise.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk about the story of how you found these, which is fascinating. Jurgen, you've had a chance to read through, I understand, quite a bit of the diary, haven't you?
Yes, I have.
And how important is this historical record for us?
Well, it does basically two things. It complements what we already know, and it also complicates the story that has been researched by historians now for many years. It is not, if you like, a smoking gun that we find in that diary. It is, however, a very important document conveying an idea about the atmosphere that was prevalent among the Nazi elite at the crucial times during the Nazi regime. And it also points to some specific aspect of Rosenberg's involvement in the coming about of the final solution that I think will be relevant for future research.
Mm. And what was his role? Did he present this, the final solution?
Well, he became in charge starting in summer 1941 of administering large chunks of the occupied Soviet Union. This was a time when he was appointed as Reich Minister for the Eastern Occupied Territories, and that really encompassed an area that stretched from the Baltic Sea through Belorussia, Ukraine, down to the Black Sea.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a huge part of continental Europe with millions of Jews. And Rosenberg was being the key ideologue, as you called him in your setup piece. He was from the very first minute of the occupation committed to removing the Jews from his realm of influence. Now, he's not very specific as to how this is supposed to happen in his diary. He is oddly more specific in some of his speeches, and he is very consistent in his demand that the Jewish question will only be resolved once the last Jew has left Germany, and for Europe, it will only be solved once the last Jew has left Europe.
Mm. It must be hard to read these, isn't it?
It is. It also is written in a rather truncated, not very literary style. There are lots of abbreviations. It's not really code, but it takes a while to get into it, really.
Yeah, and it's not. It's written in German.
That's true. Yes.
Has it been translated yet?
Not yet. What's up on the Holocaust Museum's website are scan images of the pages that were handed over to the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in December last year, mm-hmm. together with transcriptions. These transcriptions are in German. We are working currently on an annotated critical edition of the diary in German as well as in English.
Mm-hmm. Henry, the diary, according to the L.A. Times article, was found in the final days of World War II, hidden behind a false wall in a Bavarian castle, which is quite a story in itself.
Yes.
What happened to it then?
Well, the army actually took it in custody, and they inventoried the portions of the diary that they had. This was crucial in determining the fact that Dr. Kempner later had it. We traced the diary for several years in the custody of prosecution office in Nuremberg, and after a certain amount of time, we determined that it basically fell out of view.
And you made it your mission at what point in your life that you were going to find this thing?
Well, almost from the start, I guess.
Really?
It was in 1997 that we first got wind of the fact that Dr. Kempner's papers were up for grabs, so to speak. Based upon information that I received from various scholars, we knew about the fact that this was an important diary and that Dr. Kempner was most likely the one who had it.
Mm-hmm. And tell us a little bit about your father. He was a Holocaust survivor, wasn't he?
Well, the museum would characterize him as a Holocaust survivor because he had to leave Germany in 1937 in order to... Well, he was a refugee, basically.
Mm-hmm.
He would not have considered himself a Holocaust survivor because he was able to leave in 1937 together with his sister and father and made it to New York. Other members of the family were what they would consider true Holocaust victims. They perished in Auschwitz and places unknown.
Mm-hmm.
Other members of the family who actually had suffered, for example, through Kristallnacht, which was a night in November 9th, 1938, where Jewish synagogues throughout Germany were burned down. And some members of the family who actually endured that and survived and made it to the United States, they probably would have been considered the true Holocaust survivors. But albeit the museum would consider him a Holocaust survivor.
Mm. Is he still alive?
No, unfortunately, he passed away about 30 years ago.
Oh, so he didn't have a chance to see your life's work.
And unfortunately not, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, regretfully.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, at least you know. And,
yeah.
I'm
confident he would have been very pleased.
I'm sure he would have been very pleased. The story of how this was found, though, good grief, this took years, didn't it?
About 17.
Oh, my gosh.
More or less,
yeah. Oh, well, trace it for us because it's a fascinating story encompassing the FBI and people who were leading you astray and
yes.
houses filled with documents. It's an amazing story.
Well, it was in 1997, in March 1997, It was in March 1996. It was the 50th reunion of Nuremberg staff. Two of Dr. Kempner's former legal secretaries visited the museum and urged us to contact his two heirs. That would be his two sons, Andre and Lucien, try to convince them to donate this material to the museum. And we did. I contacted them, and they agreed that they would very much like to donate the papers to the museum. So it was in 1997 that actually four of us from the museum, including myself and Jürgen, we visited the house in Lansdowne, Pennsylvania, where Dr. Kempner had lived. Dr. Kempner had passed away in 1993.
Mm-hmm.
He had left his entire estate to his two sons and allowed one of his legal secretaries to live in the house together with the contents for the remainder of her life. Unfortunately, the will was rather vague. It was not the greatest will that a major legal scholar would have written.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we went up to Lansdowne, Pennsylvania, to look at this material, and what we found was a major hoarder's nest.
Oh, my.
It was like, I always liken it to Miss Havisham's house in
yes.
Great Expectations.
Right.
There was stuff everywhere. Boxes upon boxes. The place was extremely dirty. There was material everywhere, and it was quite a shock to us when we found it.
Yeah.
So what we did was drew up a diagram of what we found on three of the floors: the basement, the first floor, and the second floor, where Ms. Lipton, the person who was lived in the house, had told us the material was. And we later wrote a letter to the heirs explaining what we found. And they had agreed, of course, to donate the materials, but Mrs. Lipton had not wanted us to remove this material, because she was able to live in the house together with the contents, the famous phrase. So there was problems with the will, and which prevented us from actually taking possession of the material. But by 1999, those problems had been solved, and they contacted us and told us to go back up to Lansdowne to make plans to remove the material, and Jürgen was also among that team. Well, what we found was that major portions of the material had been removed soon after our first visit, and they had been sent to the Robert Kempner Collegium in Lewiston, New York, which was essentially a clapboard house with a sign on the front saying, "This is the Dr. Robert Kempner
Collegium." Oh, my gosh.
So we contacted the Lansdowne police and the Delaware County police, and they talked to one of the people that had actually removed the material from the house. That was the other legal secretary, Dr. Kempner. And eventually, in July of 1999, we got a team. In August 1999, we were allowed to go up to Lewiston, New York, in order to pack the material up that had actually been illegally removed. And so I went up there, and Ms. Lester, the legal secretary, was not pleased. And she greeted me with basically screaming at me to get off her property. Mm. But the police and her attorney who was there convinced her that it would probably be the best thing if she allowed us to remove the material. And so we packed up the stuff that she indicated had been removed from the Kempner home, and we moved it back to Washington. And so we began to inventory all the material. In 2001, we got a call from a junk dealer in Pennsylvania who had been engaged to take the material out of the Kempner house in Lansdowne in order to make the house ready for sale.
Mm-hmm.
And he indicated that we had forgotten 15 feet of stuff.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh.
Yes. from the house, and that he was offering it for sale to the museum. For about $100,000.
Ah.
And at that point, we contacted the FBI.
Oh.
And the senior historian for the museum and I went up to Philadelphia, met with the FBI, and then that day went down to this gentleman's house in Pennsylvania, which is near Chester, and to look at the material. We were, in fact, looking for the Rosenberg diary.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody who had come before us to do the same thing was a major Holocaust denier named David Irving.
Oh, my.
He didn't find the diary either. So went to the house, we entered, we determined that, yes, this was Dr. Kempner's material. We walked out of the house to, you know, ostensibly to contact the museum to see if we would pay, they would pay $100,000. And the FBI agents walked in right after us, after we left, took the material, packed it up in cars, and sent it back up to Philadelphia to their office, where it sat until about 2002, I believe, where we tried to get it back. So the members of the National Archives and myself and went up to Philadelphia to give affidavits about this, but the Department of Justice determined that they would rather not go to trial. So after the National Archives removed what they determined really was properly the National Archives, they determined that we would flip a coin, and whoever had the first won the toss would have the first choice of what to take. And so we serially went through this material, picking what we wanted from the stuff. We had the right to copy anything that we lost, so at least we have that information.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we brought this material back to the museum to be integrated into the inventoried material, and then things went on until around 2002, when we got a call from an archivist that the legal secretary, Jane Lester, who had met me in Lewiston, how cordially had met me in Lewiston.
Right.
Yes. That she had been engaged by the two sisters of Ms. Lester to inventory about 300 feet of documents that we had not been able to see, that had been hidden from us when we went up there in 1999.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, she passed away, but the attorneys for the guardians contacted us and told us that they would be interested in donating this material to the museum. So we went up. To make a long story short, this material is in a storage locker up in Amherst, New York, and we packed the stuff up and brought it back to the museum to be integrated back into the material that had already been inventoried.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, the diary was not among any of this material.
Right.
So in 2006, it was, and we had actually contacted we had been in touch with the FBI during this period. And in 2006, I wrote a memo and for the FBI about why the museum should have this, why this is properly government property, that because this had legally been gifted to the museum, which is an independent federal establishment in the United States government in the executive branch. And unfortunately, nothing happened. The FBI wasn't able to pursue this. In about 2010, I contacted people in the Department of Justice, and they contacted the FBI. We met with all of them. They tried to pursue this, and unfortunately, nothing was able to be done. We were looking for the diary, and we knew, I should go back a bit, we knew, we traced this diary definitively to a Dr. Herbert Richardson, who was a publisher up in Lewiston, New York.
Mm-hmm.
When I was talking with one of the guardians of Ms. Lester, one of her sisters, she mentioned the fact that she was present at an interview that the German magazine Der Spiegel had given, and she had indicated in this interview, and of course they were interested in knowing where the diary was, and that she had given this diary to Dr. Richardson for safekeeping.
Hmm.
So we knew that it, in fact, was in his possession.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we exhausted all the, so to speak, chain of command in the government, and we decided to engage a private investigator. And in 2012, the private investigator went up to Lewiston, and he determined that Dr. Richardson indeed had the diary, and he contacted the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, Department of Homeland Security, because this material had basically been illegally imported into the United States. And they contacted Dr. Richardson. They subpoenaed Dr. Richardson. They opened a grand jury investigation and convinced Dr. Richardson that it would probably be in his best interest to donate the diary to the museum. And it was in early 2013 that indeed the diary came into the possession of Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
After all those years,
after
you finally got to see the diary.
Yeah.
Amazing. There obviously were many, many other documents, too, and we'll ask Jürgen what other treasures and important pieces of information there may have been in that. And I was interested when he said a Holocaust denier had tried to get the diary as well. Why? To burn it? Why? So we'll continue our conversation and welcome phone calls. Isn't that a story? What a story. Our guests this hour are Henry Mayer, who's just given you the phenomenal details on trying to trace down this diary, senior advisor on archives in the Office of Collections at the United States Holocaust Museum. Jürgen Matthios is also with us, director of applied research at the United States Holocaust Museum. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And that's how you can reach us, okay? We're also on Facebook, if you'd like to leave a comment, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and on Twitter, at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will go to phone calls. I want to ask Jürgen, though, a couple questions. So you had all kinds of information, Jürgen, in addition to the diary. Were many of those papers of great importance or not?
Well, it's indeed the case that Alfred Rosenberg, in his many capacities and functions he had within the Nazi Party, left a lot of papers. Many were destroyed during the war due to deliberate destruction of specifically classified secret papers, but also through Allied bombing. But nevertheless, there was an awful lot left that was then intercepted by the Allies. A lot of that was processed, as Henry has described, in preparation for the Nuremberg trials. And these materials are now dispersed over many archives, the Federal Archive in Germany, a little bit at the National Archive in Washington, also, of course, at the Holocaust Museum, and also in some other European archives.
Mm.
That, of course, is the basis of the work for any historian. Now, the museum has as part of its mission the task of rescuing the evidence. So basically anything that pertains to the Holocaust and its history, and that conveys an impression about the historicity of the fact, is of interest to the museum. So these records are part of what the museum has here in its collections. They are really vast, massive collections that are very attractive to anyone who is interested in the history of Nazi Germany in general, and particularly, of course, on the history of the Holocaust.
Yes.
We have here at the museum, on average, about 25 to 30 fellows per year from all around the world, and they rely on that material.
Mm-hmm.
And if it wouldn't be for the efforts of Henry and his colleagues and the colleagues from our archival branch, the collections branch, this would not be available. So it takes this persistence in rescuing the evidence, in making it available, in processing it.
Yes.
You can imagine from what Henry has described, these hundreds and hundreds and feet of material. You need to describe what's in there before anyone can properly use it. So that's the task of the archivist, and that's what historians like me rely on in working through this material and then producing whatever publications we produce.
Right. Have you thought, I don't know why my mind is thinking of a film, but it's such a dramatic story that you almost want to see it in front of your eyes, don't you? If you could give us a film about all of this, it would be amazing, wouldn't it?
It's true. In fact, we have speculated, Henry and I, already about the prospect of this making it to Hollywood.
Oh, you did? Okay. Oh, yeah. I'm glad I wasn't alone.
So it might be an attractive script, in fact, for a movie producer. But, of course, there are two stories here.
Right.
One is the one that Henry focused on, which is the long path towards this document returning to federal custody and, in this case, being housed at the USHMM. And the other story is, of course, the historical events that are depicted in the diary.
Yes.
And all the other papers. And both are complex. The one that deals with Rosenberg and involves the diary is probably more complex because there is a lot. There are many moving parts and there are many pieces to the puzzle. Now, the diary that we now have, the 425 pages that were turned over to the museum, are important pieces in that puzzle, but it takes much more material, again, parts of which we have here in Washington, to really understand what was going on at the time.
Right, to piece it all together. And could you tell me why a Holocaust denier was looking to find this diary, Henry?
That would be trying to guess his motives, and I really don't know. Before he was a Holocaust denier, he was a fairly reputable historian.
Ah.
So maybe he was trying to find original primary documentation. I don't know.
Yeah.
I know that on his website, I was basically accused of trying to, steal this document from this poor gentleman in Pennsylvania. But I assure you, that was not the case.
No, it was definitely not the case.
I did want to mention something that Jürgen had mentioned regarding Rescue the Evidence. One of the things about this entire saga, there are a number of documents, not including artifacts, et cetera, that were taken home as trophies by people in the service or people in the civilians who worked for the government. And it would be appropriate for them. We realize that the tremendous role they played in defeating this evil, to consider putting them back into the public's domain, that these really belong to the people. And some of them might have been, inconsequential, but some of them, like the Rosenberg diary, could prove to be extremely important for research. So if there are people who are listening that may have any of this material, they should really consider giving it to, if not the museum, some other reputable organization.
And as you said in the article, you were quoted as saying, the diary describes a great evil, perhaps will instruct future generations about where evil can lead.
Yes, that's what our mission is.
Yeah, exactly. We have Joe from Prairie du Chien who's writing in, Rosenberg sounds like a Jewish last name to some extent. Do we know the background of the person who wrote this diary? Jürgen?
Well, there has been some speculation about the ancestry of Alfred Rosenberg even before the Nazis came to power. It seems to be the case, although we don't have really all that solid evidence, that Rosenberg's family was Baltic German. The other part was partly French. There is no indication that anyone could really seriously trace that points to the fact that he would have been of a Jewish or part Jewish ancestry.
Mm-hmm. What was it like for you, Henry, after you spent all of these years and considering your family history when you found the very thing that you had been searching for? What did you do? Did you sit down and collapse and start reading it, or what?
Well, Jürgen and I went up there on April 5th, 2013. And I remember that day, and to take a look and confirm that this was indeed the diary. And, you know, we confirmed that one of the passages that Dr. Kempner had quoted in one of his articles, of course, that nobody had ever seen about a conversation that he had with Hitler, that was the first page that we looked at. And, you know, I basically sat there and breathed, took a deep breath, mm-hmm. and thought, wow, this is over. Mm-hmm. I found it. And I was just overcome, I guess you could say. It was just an amazing thing. You know, if you're looking for something for 17 years, mm-hmm. and you finally find it, and this is a major achievement, at least I think, and a major contribution to the primary documentation of the Holocaust.
Yes.
I was just, you know, there's a picture of me with my thumbs up, having a big, broad smile. So that about sums it up.
Yeah, it sure does. And for those of you who are tuning us in and have no idea what we're talking about, listen to the first part of the interview because you want to hear the story. But you can also reference, and I think it's on our Facebook page, we first learned about this. I should have learned about it earlier. But the Los Angeles Times had a piece recently, The Search for the Lost Nazi Diary. And it's the story of Henry Mayer, who was one of our guests, son of a Holocaust survivor. His mission for 17 years to find this journal that was kept by Alfred Rosenberg. He was the Nazi Party's chief ideologue. He was a confidant of Adolf Hitler. And the diary covers the years 1936 to 1944, accounts of meetings with Hitler describing what was going on in the inner circle and revealing Rosenberg's deep, deep evil anti-Semitism. So that's what the search was for. And we're welcoming phone calls, too. Some of you may know about this story quite a bit, or you have basic questions, whatever. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Jürgen, there was also mention, was it in the diaries, or did you know about this earlier, of the Jewish art treasures that had been confiscated that he was describing in the diary? Value $250 million, and he was about to show them to Hitler, I believe, wasn't he?
Yes, that's true. This is a part of Rosenberg's function that is pretty well known. In fact, this is probably the most successful part of his entire career until at least 1941. He was appointed to that position in 1940, and against heavy competition from other high-ranking Nazis, Goebbels, the propaganda minister, was earmarked to do that job for a while, but Rosenberg obviously had the better contacts to Hitler, so he got that job. The organization was called Einsatzstab Reichsleiter Rosenberg, or the acronym here would be ERR, and the ERR was one of the most, if not the most efficient, art looting agencies that the Germans sent throughout German occupied Europe, in search for valuable artwork, libraries of any value, scientific, scholarly, or monetary, archives of Jewish and other institutions. And all that material was organized on site, then centralized through repositories where it was sorted, and then brought back to Germany. And I'm not sure whether you or any of your listeners know, there recently has been a news item in the German media about a major art collection found last summer, which raised that very issue as to provenance, where this material comes from. And ER is not directly involved, but it is clearly, it indicates that this is an ongoing business. It's not as if all the artwork was restituted after the war. The Monuments Men could only do so much. But there is still a lot of artwork that is in museums, in private hands, that probably shouldn't be there.
Right.
Where there might be people who have a right to claim that material, and where museums might have to answer some questions as to how they acquired that material.
Absolutely. Do you know, Jürgen, we did a show on that last summer when that treasure trove was discovered by the guy who sort of lived with it and never went anywhere. Do you know what the status is of all that art? Is it still in a warehouse, supposedly being very slowly documented now?
I'm not sure, but I think the first step was really to make known what the person had in his possession and to find out whether there are any claims. Now, as far as I understand that story, part of it was acquired in a legal way, and that means that probably around the mid-30s or a little later, the father of the current owner would have had the possibility to acquire at very discounted rates artworks that were no longer regarded as being art.
I
because
see.
This was degenerate art or
yes.
some other kind of stuff that was no longer, well, call it en vogue. So he would acquire that and well, after the war, to some extent, make a living off it, and he would sell some of that material. Other material comes from much more murky channels, but I think this is still an ongoing story and just perhaps one story of many that might surface later.
Yes. Jim from Osceola writes in, will the diary ever be published? Henry?
Well, I think probably Jürgen should probably answer that because he is planning to do exactly that.
Okay.
Exactly. So what's in the works right now is a German edition with our partner institution, the Institute for Contemporary History in Munich. And there will be an English language edition, which might take a little longer because obviously the material needs to be translated. We hope to have that out by spring next year.
Mm. Okay. And what about at the museum, the Holocaust Museum and elsewhere in the world, did a lot of people keep diaries or are there extensive records from people who were actually involved in this, in the Holocaust, in this evil, so that we can read what their words are? Do you have a lot of them?
Yes, there is a lot of material that is of that kind. It's not always a diary in a physical sense. It might be just fragmentary notes. Sometimes it's also letter collections that have a diary function. There is, in fact, a lot of that material. Now, the attention being paid to the Rosenberg diary should not deflect from the fact that there is more material coming from Holocaust victims than from perpetrators, because among the Nazi elite, Rosenberg was one of two who kept a more or less regular diary. The other one is Goebbels, who was a much more devoted and committed diary writer since the mid-20s. Rosenberg is more on and off, so you find bits and pieces with huge gaps. And if Henry says the chapter is closed, well, it is in a way, but if we look at these huge gaps in the diary, we would want to know why that is. Is it because Rosenberg didn't write in these many months that we have no diarist entries for? Or is it because material is still out there somewhere? Or it might have been destroyed during the war. We just don't know.
And where was it initially found again? It was in some Bavarian. Where was it?
In his home, I think it was.
Well, there is a kind of a record of how it came into the possession of the U.S. Army. It doesn't really give the specific, but it says a Bavarian castle. Now, it could be in the vicinity of Coburg. There is Lichtenfels, is the name of the place, which also was the place where other documents were found. And I think that might be the place where this diary also came from.
Yeah.
I should mention that there are a lot of people who survived, the victims, that also wrote diaries. And there's a large amount of material, large amount of diaries and journals that they had kept, probably a lot more than the perpetrators.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
We'll welcome phone calls and continue this fascinating story in just a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. In the minutes that remain, if you would like to join us, writing or calling in, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Henry Mayer is the senior advisor on archives in the Office of Collections at the United States Holocaust Museum, and it was his 17-year journey to find this. It's an incredible story, and worth reading about the story in addition to all that is found within the diary, Rosenberg's diary, including meetings with Hitler and all kinds of important information. Also joining us is Jürgen Matthäus, and he is Director of Applied Research Scholars at the United States Holocaust Museum. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you want to join our conversation, feel free to do so, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Let's give this one to you, Jürgen. I was interested in this entry in the diary, and I wonder if there were many. September 12, 1931, he writes that Germany had obtained reports that Stalin planned to send 400,000 Germans to Siberia. What was the entry on that day, and were there follow-ups to that, and what was the response?
Well, the year is actually 1941.
41, yeah, sorry.
This is a couple of months after the beginning of the war against the Soviet Union. You can see here the broader context within which Nazi politicians like Rosenberg, and by that time, keep in mind, he is minister for the occupied Eastern Territories already, the mindset and the broader scope within they were operating. So what they became aware of and were looking for were any indications that related to ethnic political planning on the part of their enemies. Now, of course, the enemy closest to them was across the eastern border, and that was Stalin. Stalin had his own ideas and in fact policies regarding ethnic minorities and deportations. And persecutions were part of that. So for Nazi Germany, which had a track record of making use of the German minority being abused in any country, from Czechoslovakia before it was dismembered, via Poland in 1939 in the run-up to the German attack in September, to the Soviet Union, they would use these incidents or rumors or just fabrications to come up with what they would call reprisals. Now, you could speculate that there is a correlation between the news coming out of the Soviet Union that Stalin has started to deport the ethnic Germans in the Soviet Union further east, and the planning for the deportation of the German Jews, which is happening around the very same time. September 1941 marks the transition in Hitler's decisions from, well, let's deport the German Jews sometime after the end of the war, to, well, let's do it now.
Mm-hmm.
And this is exactly what's happening around that time period, in conjunction with an increasing number of mass executions that are taking place in the occupied Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the place and the region where the transformation from persecution to mass murder takes place. So this is really where the Holocaust takes shape. First in Lithuania in the first weeks of Operation Barbarossa, the German attack on the Soviet Union in late June 41, and then developing over time into other areas behind the German front line. Until by the end of 1941, you have between 500 to 800,000 Jews killed in that area,
mm-hmm.
Men, women, and children, and of course the inclusion of women and children into these mass murder actions marks a major stepping stone towards genocide. In fact, it is genocide,
mm-hmm.
and what it then took was the expansion of that policy to other regions, and that's what's happening in the course of 1942, so that it becomes a really European-wide
right.
Project.
Yeah. Gary is calling in from Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Gary.
Hello. I wanted to ask the guest about a book that Rosenberg has been known to have written in addition to The Lost Diary. That was the book called The Myth of the 20th Century, very important to the early movement, the Nazi movement. Could you explain something about that book for us?
Right. Well, this is the magnum opus, if you like, of Rosenberg. He published this in 1930 and had worked on this for several years. It is one of the most important books of the Nazi era. And it is second directly after Hitler's book, Mein Kampf. Rosenberg comes up in this book with a very amorphous and vague philosophy that would reflect his line of thinking since basically the end of World War I. Now, there are different elements in there that are all kind of equally murky, but there is a strong focus on two enemies. One is Bolshevism, and the other one is the Jews. And Rosenberg is one of those proponents who had stressed the union and the strong correlation between these two groups. So Judeo-Bolshevism was really something that he pushed very strongly into the German political environment after World War I. Now, keep in mind, Rosenberg originally comes from Reval, Tallinn, in Estonia. He had spent some time in Moscow during World War I. He knew Russian. He was of Baltic German background. So he picked up some of the anti-Semitism that was very prevalent in the early Soviet Union or in Russia after the Civil War, and brought it to Germany, where it was integrated into this extremely vitriolic, ultra-nationalist, right-wing discourse that took shape after the end of World War I, which, of course, as you know, was a disastrous ending on Germany's part, with all the frustrations of the nationalists seeing the nation basically going down the drain. They were looking for explanations, and Judeo-Bolshevism was a perfect explanation in their mind, and Rosenberg was one of those thinkers, if you like, ideologues, really, mm-hmm. who were pushing that button very, very heavily.
Mm. Thank you very much for your call, Gary. What are you working on now, Henry? What are you looking for, Henry?
Well, we're looking for more documents, more collections. That's one of my principal jobs, is to try to look for obituaries and newspaper articles, word of mouth, doing some searching on Google, on the Internet, and trying to find other documents, other collections that really should be donated to the museum or to any other reputable organization. We had actually submitted, we did a report about material that we really would like to complement our holdings, and I'm working on that. I'm working at the UN to get materials from the UN, both their War Crimes Commission microfilm and also material from the United Nations Rehabilitation Agency, which operated displaced persons camps after the war. There's a lot of material out there.
Yes. And I meant to ask you, the condition of the diary when you found it, was it in fairly good shape or not?
Yes, it was in fairly good shape. Dr. Kempner had taken very good care of it.
Uh-huh.
In fact, as I mentioned, Ms. Lester's guardian had mentioned the fact that that she had given it to Dr. Richardson for safekeeping. And she had mentioned the fact that it was in three red binders, that when she had seen it in Dr. Kempner's home. And sure enough, when the Immigration and Customs Enforcement found it, it was in three red binders.
Yeah.
So he took very good care of it, I have to say that.
Yeah. Well, this is just quite a story, and you have been filled with information and so gracious for being with us this hour. Thank you, gentlemen, so much.
My pleasure.
It was fascinating.
Thank you.
Yeah, our pleasure. Thank you so much. Our guest, Henry Mayer, Senior Advisor on Archives in the Office of Collections at the United States Holocaust Museum. Also joining us, Jürgen Matthäus. He is director of applied research scholars, people coming, as you heard him say, from all over the world to examine and give us the historical accuracy and the story of all this information from many different people and many different sources to give us the narrative of the horrors of the Holocaust. And he is director of research scholars at the United States Holocaust Museum. The article, I believe, is on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dent Show. So read it. It's really quite a story. Thanks to Judith Sears-Poisson for producing this program, and thanks to Cynthia Schuster for on-air production here in Milwaukee. Tomorrow at 1 o'clock, we'll look at Putin's Russia in light of the current crisis in Ukraine, and one of our guests will be the former Moscow correspondent for NPR. Thanks for listening to this hour, and thank you.